Hello and welcome to the broadcast. I'm your host David Brooks from Broadstone, and this time I'm joined by Louisa Harold, Client Director at trustee firm Zedra, Andy Palmer, Partner at BDO in the Pension Covenant Advisory Team, and my colleague Chris Rice, who's Head of Buyout here at Broadstone. Hi guys, welcome along to the broadcast. This week we are talking about buyout, and in particular we're talking about trustee decision making and some of the challenges for trustees, and also the sort of the growth area, I suppose, of insurer covenant and how trustee conversations should happen around there. So just to kick us off, Louisa, I was interested in your thoughts on what the main challenges for trustees making decisions around the buyout process.
Yeah, hi, thanks. Hi. So yeah, I'm Louisa. I am a professional trustee. I work with around 10 schemes, and sort of in the last couple of years, I have helped a couple of schemes to buy out, and I'm currently working on one quite actively at the moment. So hopefully I've been through this a couple of times. So trustee decision-making process, I mean, I guess there's no single point for this. It's kind of a series of decisions that build up over time. And I guess for many trustee boards, they are aware for a while that it's their objective and the sponsor's objective that they want to ultimately buy out. And it's kind of shaping that journey along the way. You know, there's lots of mini decisions along the way. I suppose big decisions, as you move into the process more formally, are around who you're going to work with, because that's going to play a huge part in how you approach the market and how you do things. The processes that I've worked on have been slightly different each time. So I think thinking carefully about who you're going to work with, having someone that understands you and the sponsor will be useful. So think carefully about that. And then I suppose the other bit up front as well that I think is really important that isn't always done until later in the process is the sort of legal advice, the really key legal points, getting them ironed out early on, so that you have full sight of any surprises further down the line. Those are the big ones, I suppose, early on. And actually, sorry, one further one I wanted to mention is if you are a large trustee board, or even not necessarily large, but it can be difficult to gather you, how as trustees do you want to approach it? Do you want a subcommittee, for example? That's something probably worth ironing out early on as well.
Yeah, I was thinking of whether you delegate any of those decisions to a smaller group, or that speeds things up. You know, I suppose if you're working with lay trustees as well, this would be their one and only time on this ride, so it's difficult to know what level of training you and sort of leveling them up to be able to make these decisions you want to do, and whether you can just pick out a few key trustees to manage that process through.
Yeah, I think most trustees and lay trustees will be really keen to be involved all the way through. You said, it's the big item that will, it's sort of almost their last really important role to play for the scheme. So they will want to be involved, and they will need the training. Absolutely. I think it's as you get really, so early on, definitely the whole trustee board to be involved. I guess the role of a sort of subcommittee will be perhaps for later on, once, you know, in terms of, you know, which insurer you're going to work with, that's a whole trustee board conversation. How do you tackle any really big problems? That's a whole board decision. It's perhaps later on as you get into the nitty gritty of really finer contract points, if you have any, and I suppose post buy-in as well, that's when a subcommittee really comes into its own, as you sort out any data items and stuff like that, when again it might be really small technical points that are coming up, and it might at that point be just not valuable to involve the whole trustee board. But big ticket wise, I think that's right. I think the whole trustee board will want to play a part, is my experience. And everyone has something to add.
I was just thinking as you were talking, is there a sort of sense that things do sort of speed up towards the end, and you need that kind of, you know, quick fire decision making process? Well, at the start, it probably starts right. Okay, there's a few, we'll come on to it maybe in a second, but you know, we've got some big things to sort out. And then it sort of funnels down into lots of right, just to make a decision here, you know, let's get this done. And we've got probably some time pressure for deals to be done, employer wanting to get this over the line, all those kind of things.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly been my experience, that as soon as you go out for, once you decide you're ready to go out for quotes, you're kind of on a bit of a timeline that's a little bit out of your control. You know, you get the quotes back from the insurers and they'll be guaranteed for a certain amount of time. So you've got that deadline to work to. So it can become, it depends what things are being thrown out, but if you get some decision points as part of that, then yeah, you can find that you're up against it a little bit, and it can become a bit high pressured. I don't know, Chris, do you find similar?
Yeah, exactly. I think when you're working towards when you're setting your crystallisation date and the asset disinvestments and all of those final decisions, and we're seeing that insurers now are, especially if you go exclusive, which was something I was going to come on to, are requiring the deal when the guaranteed quote is issued to be completed within a really set period of time, ideally 4 to 6 weeks. So that is quite condensed, definitely. Just coming back to who you're going to work with, I think the biggest challenge that I'm seeing is the exclusive point, and more deals now we are seeing that insurers are requiring exclusivity. So it doesn't mean that we can typically look at, apart from at the very early stage, the focus and choosing the insurer on the ESG credentials, the financial strength and the work that Andy's team can do, and the admin standards. But most importantly, especially where you've got the company involved, is that price, where you have a well-run business with a procurement department that any contract over £10,000 needs to go out to competitive tender, and we're entering into multi-million pound contracts and saying, well, this is who you've got, take it or leave it. So I think that's quite hard for the trustees, although with advice around that, around the financial strength of relative insurers potentially that you could work exclusively with, and for me on pricing it and other advisors around the contractual terms, you're still sort of choosing in the dark, and I think that's quite difficult.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It's really difficult when you're pushed to go exclusive from the outset. I found it, you know, it feels unfair somehow but that's sort of reality. So yeah,
I say some of the challenges that we've seen is trustees actually getting the commitment from the employer to that process. I mean, historically, a buy-in has been seen as the gold standard, but that wisdom is seemingly being increasingly challenged, particularly if you've got a very robust sponsor. And getting sponsor support is absolutely critical. In some circumstances, the employer's covenant can be very robust. And the employer doesn't necessarily see the value in a bulk annuity transaction. And also in some circumstances, actually entering in that transaction could result in the employer incurring a technical loss in its P&L and its balance sheet, which they don't want to do for various commercial reasons. So rolling the wicket ahead of any intention, I think, is absolutely critical for trustees.
As an interesting point, actually, you were talking about, you know, the changing wisdom of buyer. And just thinking of some of those trustee decision points around some of the compromises that trustees have to make. And I've had it with a few of my clients when, you know, like you say, the buy-in, buy-out is the gold standard. And then they start saying, oh, but we like doing this with our members, whatever, some discretion they have. We have always done that. Are we going to lose that? And we say, yes, probably, you know, the insurer probably isn't going to do that. They're going to want you to make a decision on that now, and that'll be it. And they're like, oh, we didn't realize that. We didn't appreciate that. And that's, whether it's the right or wrong, but that emotional reaction is actually quite, you actually see on their face, you know, oh, right, okay, I'm not sure about this now. Maybe this isn't the right thing for us. It's quite an interesting point. I don't know if you guys have seen the similar thing.
I didn't have any really tricky ones on the two that I've worked through, but definitely I agree. I can absolutely see that situation, no question. And I am having similar conversations. So I mentioned I'm, you know, beginning to get very serious on a third one where we're getting closer to seeking quotes or a single quote in an exclusive situation. But that's sort of coming to a head now, I would say, those kind of conversations, and absolutely to Andy's point, seeing sponsor rethinking objectives from perhaps what they had thought before. I think that's definitely something that we'll see more and more of. And it comes from a trustee point of view. I think the covenant bit becomes so critical in those situations.
Of course, we've seen a real growth recently in the number of bulk annuity transactions, but the marketplace is constrained to some extent by resources, not necessarily capital, but human resources. So not every scheme is going to be able to enter a bulk annuity transaction. So I think some of the challenges will be around, well, what are the alternatives? Because there are different end-game solutions, whether it's a run-on or whether or not it's a super fund type of transaction. So there's different options out there that trustees like Louisa have to consider, and there's far more options perhaps than there were previously.
I think the member experience that you referred to, Dave, and discretions has come further up the agenda than it was initially, largely from experience and trustees and us brokers dealing with it, but also some of the insurer products where they are requiring templates and standard benefits. Obviously, the extreme of that is the potential PPF consolidator, where benefits could be quite significantly changed. But even something simple like changing the day of a month a pensioner's paid does start trustees thinking, oh, actually, do we need to go down that straitjacketed route? Is there another insurer that would be a bit more flexible with us? So I think the discretions and the member experience is coming further up the agenda.
Something I was grappling with the other day, which is really feels frustrating, is on this very point, and I'm going slightly technical here, but the GMP equalisation, we're sort of at the point where we're ready almost to actually, calculations have been done, we've talked it through, we've thought about method, we're ready to almost, not quite, but almost ready to implement. This is on the scheme where we're also thinking about getting a quote very, very, sort of almost tomorrow type thing. We've done almost all of the work, data work and benefits work. And yet we're told we're better off holding back on actually implementing the equalisation until after the buy-in because of exactly what you were saying, Chris, things around fitting into templates. If you're doing dual records, you can't fit into a template if you've already done it. The insurer will do it afterwards, but not at the outset. So it's like, oh, really? It feels wrong after all these years to be slowing down a GMP exercise where we're finally getting to the end. But I guess that's a problem of today and not necessarily of tomorrow, because things will change, no doubt.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it makes me think of the sort of the flow of that buyout process and how a scheme can know where they are on that process. What is the key driver? Is it the funding triggers a conversation, or is it inevitability of the funding coming? Do you think, let's look at the data and make sure that's ready? I know this is talked about in the industry a lot, but it does seem to be not an iterative process. It just seems to be lots of things all at once, and just knowing how to prioritize that is. It would be interesting to get your thoughts on how you manage that process.
I think this comes, it's always frustrating, isn't it, saying it depends and it's scheme by scheme. I think you've been thinking about it as trustees for quite some time. Certainly as a professional trustee, I'll have it at the back of my mind. And so it's about picking the right moment. If you've got a valuation, it's a really good time to say, okay, we are expecting to be over 90% on solvency basis. We should be having a serious conversation now about planning ahead. But it's picking the right time for the conversation and knowing what your budgets are. I mean, some sponsors have really, really tight budgets, and you've got to, sort of respect that. And again, it comes back to picking your moments. It's not that you're never expecting that work to happen or need to happen, but it's about going about it sensibly. So I think it really does depend. I mean, sometimes the LDI crisis meant some schemes, their funding, accelerated really, really quickly. So I think there has been a rush of work to get this stuff done quickly, and insurer pricing believed to be quite favourable in, sort of first half 23 or whatever. you know, I think maybe that has not the case right now, but I think it did lead to a real flurry and almost like a panic or sort of disorderly approach to getting the work done as quickly as possible. Maybe that's easing off now, that sort of rush. But I think it's trying to do it in a steady way is always going to be better, isn't it? If you can. But then you don't want to miss a moment. If your funding suddenly improves and you could transact, it depends on sponsors' objectives too, of course. They may not want to rush, and things like accounting impact, really important for them. So another thing actually I did, so valuation is one trigger for a conversation. Another trigger is if you've got a sponsor where the accounting work gets quite high profile, is to actually use their accounting date as a trigger. So I've asked a few sponsors where I know we're getting closer to say, look, as part of this year end, and maybe they've been a bit difficult to engage on, do we buy in, do we not, because it seems too theoretical for them, but I know it's creeping closer as a potential option. So look at their accounting year end date, ask your actuaries to do a scenario, what would it look like if you did a buy-in? And that really, for one sponsor, it worked really well. It made them engage. They did commission that slightly extra piece of work, but at a time that was appropriate because it was just tagged on as a small add-on to their year-end work that was happening anyway. Sadly for me, it did make them come back and say, we never want to buy in. So I don't know where that will end up, but we're still not 100% funded yet, so it's still a bit theoretical, but yeah.
Some really good points there from Louisa in her experience. We've seen all of us that scheme funding changes quite quickly, and there's now many more schemes that are on the cusp of buyout or can see it much closer as a possibility than perhaps previously. So it's an ideal time if you think that this is something that's going to be possible within the next 3 to 5 years to start those discussions with employers and get that strategy agreed, particularly if it's now a case where the employer only needs to add a little bit more cash into the scheme to get it to a full solvency position. Given the demands, though, and competition for bulk annuity transactions, it's clear that the insurers are quite picky with who they're going to transact with, and working on the logistics of getting data ready is something that know, should be started as soon as possible, I think, because those are barriers to successful transactions, and it's quite clear that insurers want schemes in as good an order as possible. I think it was last year that 8 of the insurers collectively published a guide to getting schemes ready and the 10 critical things that they will be looking at. And that should be sorted out before coming to market. So that guide's really helpful and useful in making sure that schemes are as best prepared as they can be.
And I think probably 9 out of 10 of those things is not wasted work. Doing your benefit specification and a lot of it's not something you'll have to repeat, so just get on with it so you're in the right position early when you're ready to go. The only point is some of the up-to-date marital data and address data, because remember, statuses and things change, and that's just something that could be done then right towards the end when they're ready to approach the market.
So I'm just going to move us on to talking about insurer covenants. And I just wanted to get your thoughts, Andy, really about sort of the wider picture of insurer covenant. It's probably something that some people don't really think much about. I would have thought, well, they're an insurer. Why is there a need for an insurer covenant? Might be an obvious thing, but also who's more worried about it, do you think? Is it the sponsor or the trustee? I'm interested in your experience.
I think primarily it's the trustees, because effectively a bulk annuity transaction is an investment decision for the trustees, and therefore it's going to be a primary interest for them. But the decision is extremely important to employers too, if they're going to be asked to put money into a scheme to perhaps get it to that solvency position and facilitate a buyout, then they want to know that the party that they're going to be transacting with is going to offer the best value that they can achieve. It's an absolutely critical decision for any scheme. It's probably one of the most significant steps in the scheme life cycle. So from a governance perspective, I think there really is incumbent on trustees to make sure that they properly consider the counterparty risk associated with any bulk annuity transaction. Thankfully, you know, default rates amongst insurers are fairly low. And in the UK, we have a very good regulatory oversight regime through the PRA, which has a ladder of intervention and should ensure against insured default. But the purpose of insurer covenant reviews isn't just to make sure that an insurer isn't going to become insolvent, but to enable trustees to really get under the bonnet of the counterparty and make sure that they are able to demonstrate that good governance and that they do understand the financial position of the insurer that they're about to transact with. And this can be particularly important if you're comparing and in the luxury position of having two or more insurers vying for your business. And if you are just making a decision solely based on price, then you're only looking at one part of the equation rather than looking at the other side, which is, well, what's the risk profile of that insurer? Because they do vary significantly in terms of capital ratios, their investment allocations, the way in which their investments are credit rated, their levels of profitability, their size. And I think, as you said there, David, well, it's an insurance company, it's not going to go bust. I mean, people, when they buy houses, would say, well, that's a house, it's not going to fall down. But that doesn't stop you doing a level of due diligence to make sure that you know exactly what it is that you're getting into.
That's a fair challenge, Andy. I was being flippant and perhaps hyperbolic for the podcast's sake more than anything else.
No, and it's a regular challenge. And I co-lead BDO's insurer covenant service with our team of financial and insurance actuaries, and that's a question we get asked all the time. And we tend to find that purchasers of insurer covenant reviews fall into two camps: those that see it as either a necessary governance step, but their working assumption is that the insurer isn't going to default, and those that have a genuine interest in getting into the nitty gritty and really understanding that spot, that counterparty, what it looks like financially, what the structure of that insurance company is, how profitable it is, how large it is, what its solvency ratios are, et cetera, et cetera. And get a genuine interest in who they're dealing with, which as part of good governance, I think is something that trustees should be looking to do.
So is it the right time to confess that I haven't always commissioned that advice?
You won't be on your own, Louisa.
it is a very important. Obviously, there's kind of a belief, I suppose, that the insurance regime is stronger than the sponsor's covenant that you're operating under. For a lot of schemes, obviously not true for all schemes, but for a lot of schemes. It's an interesting one, and it's not one I dismiss lightly at all, so please don't think that. But I suppose my concern around strength of insurers is not something that you would necessarily receive in a report. It's kind of the unknowns and the systemic risk and those kind of things that I worry that I would be getting this. I would commission the report just to give myself some protection. It would only be almost for myself. It wouldn't actually change what we're going to do next. We'll transact if it's right, type thing. If the price is right and that's already what we've decided to do, it won't necessarily change what we're doing at that moment in time. It would just be to protect me further down the line if something did fall over and go wrong. And it kind of, I think that's where I'm at, and the extent to which the work that you do can really truly cover the systemic risk. But I'm open-minded, and I find the reports really interesting to read. So I suppose the other point here is, that as a professional trustee, I've seen these reports elsewhere. So when I read them and I find them, you know, I do think it's important to understand, to the extent that we can, the risks that are faced under the insurance regime and the differences between the insurers as well. You know, some using reinsurance, some not. And I guess that's a worry that I have for the future is the piece around reinsurance in, jurisdictions outside the UK and all that kind of thing, and where things could go wrong there in the future.
Yeah, and that's a risk shared by the PRA. You may have seen last June that the PRA wrote to the major insurance companies expressing some concerns at reinsurance and highlighting where they saw particular risk, as you said, transacting and reinsuring with overseas counterparties that are outside of the PRA's remit, and how well do the insurers understand those counterparties. I mean, the reinsurance doesn't fundamentally change the obligation of the insurer to honour its obligations, but if there was a default on a reinsurer, then obviously it could present a challenge to the insuring party. So I think you're right to raise that, absolutely, Louisa, and it looks as though it's going to be an increasing focus for the PRA.
Yeah. It feels like it should be. Sorry, go on, Chris.
Yeah, I think I was just going to agree. I think I have seen more of an interest in trustees wanting to explore in more detail the covenant of the insurer, largely caused by some of the publicity around funded reinsurance and possibly concentration of risk as well. And I think the other bit that I think trustees can say, well, is there the value in this? Of course, is when it's good to, like any covenant review, it's good today, but we saw the news yesterday with Scottish Widows now portfolio now moving across to Rothesay, so that's out of the trustees' hands to a certain extent. It doesn't mean you can just shrug your shoulders and say, well, I do this deal, and what happens to the admin, what happens to their ESG, and what happens to the covenant, we don't care about, because it might change in the future, is not necessarily the best approach to things. But there is an element of, well, yeah, we'll get as comfortable as we can today, and what will be in the future will be in the future.
And go back to the point you made earlier, Louisa, that some trustees do say that this is really for our benefit, to make sure that we're protected going forward, but that of itself is an element of good governance, and I guess why trustees take advice on a range of topics where they may feel comfortable in the decision themselves, but want to be able to point that to the level of governance within their scheme to say, well, we didn't just take it at face value. We didn't just assume that the PRA will and its oversight will protect us, and that we have actually done some due diligence. And I think particularly if you're comparing and contrasting more than one insurer, it can be really useful to understand the difference between the two, because there's 9-10 more entrants coming to the market. It's a market that's predicted to have significant growth, and if there's significant growth, there'll be new entrants coming in. So how do you make sure that you're transacting with a counterparty that's optimal for you?
It does feel like it's an area where, I mean, we're actually recording this, and Chris, you already noted one change, but quite an interesting few days for the sort of the risk transfer buyout space. We've had the Rothesay to Scottish Widows, we've had Royal London announcing entering the market, and today Debenhams were going to Clara. So, so quite a day for risk transfers. And so it is a moving feast. And so I think I was just thinking when you were talking earlier that, yeah, I mean, as more providers come in, as it does become a broader market, then with the more interesting players, like people like Clara. So I don't know whether your insurer covenant work goes to looking at Clara's model and the Clara deals. Have you, obviously there's only been two, so I don't know whether you've been involved in any to date, but
we haven't been involved in any to date, but David, but yeah, we're able to look at Clara and the other funds and asset backed journey plans and capital backed journey plans as well. So
yeah, I don't know what the other Chris. Yeah, of course. So Louisa, Chris, whether you had any thoughts on the sort of the market movements and your, in whether they're just background noise for lots of things going on, or is it, you know, interesting?
Well, I suppose it's more than background noise. I think things will, I mean, it's great. I think this, you know, the new developments that we're seeing all help. So they help sort of smaller schemes where the options are more limited. They do provide, you know, extra things to think about, extra options that may not actually be directly relevant for them. But I think that that level of choice is helpful. And even if it means as well that options for larger schemes may in itself free up some capacity for smaller schemes. I think we will see a little bit of changes and things like that continuing to evolve in terms of options for small schemes. I think, you know, it's so hard being a small scheme right now if you want to get a quote and a good quote. But I think all these things will help to just ease up on that demand supply imbalance at the moment. So I think it's really positive, but it's probably a wait and see. It's not directly, you know, Clara's not directly on the table for any of my schemes at present. That's circumstance driven. It's not because I think it's a bad thing or not helpful or anything like that. But no doubt for the ones where it is relevant, it's extremely helpful. There's no doubt about that at all. So yeah, I think it's all helpful to have different options out there open to us.
Agree with that the comments there. I think that it's great news, and more options, more capacity for across all the schemes can only be positive. I think, you know, on talking to insurers and others around the industry, the key problem is people, and new entrants in the market are taking people from other providers, whether it's administrators or other insurers. So the idea that there'll suddenly be a flood of change, I think, is what Louisa was referring to, and I think Andy's referred to this earlier as well, probably isn't going to happen. It will take time as all these new providers resource up and more people come into the industry and change, but it's going the right way, definitely.
I was going to say about Clara as well. I think, you know, this isn't their first transaction, and as with any business, if you start to build up a track record of delivering, then you're likely to attract more business. So I think that, you know, the first one was crucial, but the second one is not quite as important, but really good for that business to be able to demonstrate that they've done more than one transaction, and that gives confidence. So you will start seeing people, I think, looking at that as an alternative.
That's great. Okay, I think that's it for time today. So it leaves me just to thank the three of you for your insight today. We've really learned a lot, I think, from some of the conversations that we've had. And thank our listener for tuning in, and we'll see you again on the next episode of the broadcast.